We're lucky to have Mike with us this weekend. He's Mike's a visiting Holden before, and he's here for the weekend and offered to do some work with us about theme of individual creative spirituality. And Mike lives in Emonclaw with his son and daughter and has a studio there. A lot of background in art instruction and freelance design and working with, as a liturgical artist and liturgist. He's here to share with us in different ways this weekend. So just say more about yourself and creative spirituality for now. This is Mike Batham, March the 9th, 1990. That's for the tape.
Thank you. I probably should say a few things first before we get started. And incidentally, the time allotted for this session is relatively short, and it's just basic things to get us started, like starting a car. It's just the beginning, and the car moves and takes care of the business at hand. So at the moment, we're just starting the car. A little bit more briefly about myself, I have 2 degrees, a bachelor's and a master's degree in fine arts, which helps present part of the material that I'm as a background for myself and for the creative side of spirituality. And so that's somewhat helpful to know. I also have a master's degree in ministry from Seattle University, which the material presented here tonight and tomorrow, Sunday, is a spin-off of that. So that's sort of how I got here. I'm putting the ministry to work in my area of expertise. I'm also a high school teacher, teach art classes, and one of the things that I do for my beginning art students in a way of introduction to art and the process of art, the principles of design, introduction to color, is to have them do a circular design that is a repeating model 8 different times using shapes and forms and the primary and secondary color arrangement. And they have no idea of what it is that they are about until they've created the design and had a chance to spin it. Now, the reason that it's round is because when the object is spun, it has a chance to actually move freely like a tire in a car, so that things change and things take place. And I have 3 models here which I want to share with you. Get the light right so we can see what's going on here. I asked them to divide a piece of paper backed with cardboard. I asked them to design a shape as a pie piece and then to repeat that same design 8 different times. It's sort of a hand skills coordinated effort to begin their art process, and it's terribly boring for them. Then I asked them to work out primary and secondary colors to build dark and light patterns across the shapes of their design. And they're still bored to death and can't understand what the whole process is about. The reason I have them do that is then I ask them at the end, we take a nail and dissect the center of it, and then we spin it. And all of a sudden I've got kids running for nails, because what happens in the process, the creative side begins to take place as they see changes going on in their design. So the design shapes themselves, as they spin, melt into a different design element, and the primary and secondary colors, the dark and light patterns, then melt in together and form compound colors. And it takes me a week or so for them to get to stop doing that so they can get on to the next assignment, because suddenly they're really into the creative process. They're doing things they think they didn't have in them, and their whole attitude changes. Well, most of them. So what I'd like to do is to spin these 3 different designs, because they're going to do different things. I want you to see what happens when blue melts together with red. What happens when red melts together with yellow? What kind of compound colors are formed? And then as you begin to play, you can blink your eyes and catch the motion of something else happening. You can move your shift your eyes off in a different direction and the design will do something else. Or you can actually get caught in the design, like on television, wheels that go round, some things tend to go backwards. So you're going to see all kinds of things happening. And as I spin this, keep in mind too that in our own lives, that as we put ourselves in motion through God's care, that the Spirit within us tends to do different things. And this will become apparent as we get involved in some of the things we have to do for the rest of the weekend. So I'm going to spin this now.
Catch the light.
Colors begin to melt together. And if you blink your eye or shift your focus, other things can happen as well. Sometimes through the use of design shapes, some of the actual shapes are already moving without being spun. This, for me, these shapes tend to move without anything happening. So I get a whole classroom of kids, 25 kids doing this to each other, and the kids going, wow, excellent.
Who needs drugs?
That's right.
That's the one you just did.
Is it? You don't want to see that one again? Okay. And sometimes as they slow down, the patterns begin to come back and different colors begin to take over. A lot of what will happen during the weekend is based on story, and I'm going to tell a couple of stories tonight. One story that comes directly from Holden. And then later on in the week, we'll be doing some play activities, something surrounding the idea of art. Tomorrow morning, I'll be doing what's called a left-right brain assessment, an orientation to determine how we act out of our own brain and why we do certain things the way we do, and then go into a play activity based on that particular assessment to show how we use both the left and the right brain to pull together in a double dominant consideration. We'll also be doing some work in theory, what I consider personal theory. So a lot of this is experiential, things that I've felt, things that have happened to me, and have changed my life for the better. And a lot of these, what I'm talking about, will be of a personal reflection. So as I spun the designs, we notice that there has been changes that tend to take place. And in a spiritual consideration, I would like to think that there are a lot of things that would take place spiritually as we put our own selves into motion. On the back wall, you probably have to forgive me, but we're all visual people, but I happen to be a high visual person. And I like to write things down, and they're for your reflection and for your pondering. And as I think of the word ponder, there is a radio station in Seattle that has come up with a song called Ponderous, and it talks about a man who is living out his dream, and it's really ponderous. And I think in high school terms, when I'm working with a lot of my kids, they're really into that song because the word ponderous means heavy, man. And it really is a thought process. So that the whole idea of ponderous can be changed to a present tense consideration of not ponderous, but being able to ponder. And I would like people to simply ponder what I talk about and the kind of things that we do through some of the art play activities as either being meaningful or something that has always been in the back of their mind that has been important to them and has not been affirmed, either through their own presence or through the presence of others. And as we grow into our own creativity, we tend to take risks. And number of times that I've been at Holden, I know that Holdenites are people who do take risks. So it seems to fit right in with what I'm about here tonight. I'd like to read a brief statement from the book Will and Spirit, A Contemplative Psychology by Gerald May, a doctor and also a spiritual leader of an institute in Southern California. On the idea of risk-taking, it seems to me that spirit has something to do with the energy of our lives, the life force that keeps us active and dynamic. Will has more to do with personal intention and how we decide to use our energies. Spirit, for me, has a quality of connecting us with others, with each other, with the world around us, and with the mysterious source of all, source with a capital S. In contrast, will has qualities of independence, of personal freedom, and of decision making. And I think that we'll use both the will and the spirit to work on this particular retreat. I would like to read from the 25th chapter of Matthew, and then I would like to tell you a story that I heard right here at Holden that fits very cleverly. Matthew 25, starting at the 14th verse. Again, the realm of heaven can be illustrated by the story of a man going into another country who called together his servants and loaned them money to invest for him while he was gone. He gave 5,000 to one, 2,000 to another, and 1,000 to the last, dividing it in proportion to their abilities, and then left on his trip. The man who received the 5,000 began immediately to buy and sell with it, and soon earned another 5,000. The man with 2,000 went right to work, too, and earned another 2,000. But the man who received the 1,000 dug a hole in the ground and hid the money for safekeeping. After a long time, their master returned from his trip and called them to him to account for his money. The man to whom he had entrusted the 5,000 brought him 10,000. His master praised him for good work. "You have been faithful in handling this small amount," he told him. "So now I will give you many more responsibilities. Begin the joyous tasks I have assigned you." Next came the man who had received the 2,000 with the report, "Sir, you gave me 2,000 to use, and I have doubled it." "Good work," his master said. "You are a good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over this small amount, so now I will give you much more." Then the man with the 1,000 came and said, "Sir, I knew you to be a hard man, and I was afraid you would rob me of what I earned. So I hid your money in the earth, and here it is." But his master replied, "Wicked man, lazy slave, since you knew I would demand your profit, you should at least have put my money into the bank so I could have some interest. Take the money from this man and give it to the man with the 10,000. For the man who uses well what he is given shall be given more, and he shall have abundance. But from the man who is unfaithful, even what little responsibility he has shall be taken from him. And throw the useless servant out into the outer darkness. There shall be gnashing of teeth."
Before I go into the concept of the parable, I would like to talk to you of a story that happened here, and I think it, somebody correct me if I'm wrong, I think it was three summers ago that Darius Larson was here, and the summer was known as Something Afoot in the Universe, 3 years ago, I believe. Well, for those of you who know Darius Larson, he's tall, slim, has a nice white beard, and in some respects, when he was telling the story at one of the Eucharist service on a Sunday, I was as much taken by what the story he told as I was by the appearance of the man. I couldn't help reflect and looking at him as thinking of the Swedish cook on the Muppet Show, you know, where you
I say, horky dark and smorkin dark, and he takes the rubber chicken and throws it in the pot. So that's kind of the interesting image I had of him as he was talking. But he told a beautiful story about his daughter and himself going to the hospital to visit his grandmother, who was dying. She was in a coma. And before they went into the hospital, he took his daughter aside and said, "Now, when we get into the room, I want you to be respectful of the condition of your grandmother and not make a fuss. Stay back so that everything seems proper and right, and don't get in the way of the doctors and the nurses if they're there." Well, the daughter had other plans. They entered the room, and right away she said, "I want to go up and look at Grandma." And Darius said, "No, you can't do that. I've told you, you must stay back. But I want to go up and look closer at Grandma." Well, this kept up long enough, and finally she got her way, and she was able to approach Grandmother and view her condition. Well, the next part of that story is that the next thing she said to Darius was, "I want to go up and touch Grandmother." And he said, "No, you can't do that. She's in a coma, she's not sick, and we haven't gotten approval from the doctors to do so. And they're not here to approve that." Well, as time went on, she persisted. And finally he relented and said, "All right, be careful, just go up and touch her hand, but that's it." So the girl went up and touched her hand. And of course, then the next episode of the story goes, "Dad, I want to embrace Grandmother." Now, by this time, he knew better than to say no, so he cautiously said, "Well, I guess that'll be okay." So the girl went up and pulled a chair up and kind of laid her head down on the grandmother's chest and rested there for a bit. And then actually got up and just kind of laid across her and just embraced her to the fullest. And the grandmother came awake and opened her eyes, looked at the little girl and said, "It has been a wonderful life." Patted the girl kissed her. They shared a look of love toward one another. The grandmother then closed her eyes, and that was the last word that she said. They left, and later that evening, the grandmother died. And I can't help thinking that reflecting on that story, that if we were taken from our own lives tonight, tomorrow, would we be able to say it has been a wonderful life? And I search deeper into the meaning of that concept and wonder that I think that that grandmother, Darius' mother, lived a wonderful life because she used the giftedness that she had for living. That life for her was positive. That she experienced everything that was within her grasp and within her power, within her creative power, to do what she needed to do. That she lived in that fullness of herself, the life she was meant to live. And coming back to the parable of the talents, what really disturbs me is the ending remark in verse 30 that there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth for those who do not use their own personal resources as God intended them. And that's the essence of the weekend, is to how to discover our own personal giftedness to be the creative person that we are meant to be. And in order to get beyond that concept, I need to go into my own self and tell a story briefly about my own parents, who were both extremely gifted people. My father was a certified public accountant, but he had an extreme talent for photography. He had his own dark room. He had a number of valuable cameras. He went out and experimented and did some research in photography and began to develop his own skill as a photographer in the Northwest. My mother, on the other hand, was a very good journalist, did a number of small writings for small publications, for local newspapers. She was known as the gray-haired environmentalist of our town, and she got her points across through writing letters and addressing groups to be able to change attitudes towards making the community a better place to live. The only problem was that when they both came together, the power of each of them in making a decision at that point was, well, who's going to make their profession stronger and who is going to support? And rather than each of them working together hand in hand, they both fought each other tooth and nail to the point where, like, if you put red and green together and mix them up, you form a color neutral gray, and that's kind of what they did to themselves. They neutralized one another so that neither one of them used their talents to their fullest extent. In fact, it was so much of a struggle between them, there was so much dysfunction in that area, that both of them quit using their talents altogether. My dad stuck his pencil in his CPA books and continued to do CPA work, ignoring his photography gift, while my mother turned to anger in repressing the fact that she really wanted to be a journalist, but did not because she felt that she was not getting the support she needed from my dad to be able to do so. So when I was about 15, there was a long day argument in the house, and I was told not to come in. And I knew what was going on. They were trying to hammer out a decision who was going to dominate and who was going to follow. And the mixing of the green and the red together was continuously going on all day long. And they came out at the end of the day and said, okay, you can come in now. And both of them had a mask that I had never seen on their face before, as if they had both simply given up. And from that day on, their lives were miserable. From that day on, they lived messy lives. From that day on, to the point of their death, they died a miserable death. My dad died of emphysema. My mother died of a stroke. So I think for both of them, in not allowing themselves to be themselves and to use the giftedness that was theirs, the talent and the ability, they came to terms and decided not to live the fullness of their lives. They then neutralized each other. They were weeping inside. They were literally gnashing of teeth until their death. One of the things that I did for myself to be able to recognize that was in recognizing my own gifts as a painter, was that at their burials, I prayed to God that their gifts, and I'm just assuming, again, here we come with a bit of theory, my theory on the giftedness of individuals when they die then becomes part of the cosmos, that there is energy force out there that belongs, that has not been used, and that we can reach and grab portions of this energy. So when they both died, I prayed to God that I would be able to take that energy that was part of their life in the cosmos, and that it would be put into my heart and into my mind, and that I might be able to use that. And that was one way for me, as a gifted person, as an artist, to be able to show my love for my own parents, because they were so locked in battle together that the rest of the family kind of got forgotten. And it's taken my two brothers and myself considerable time to unlock the mystery of that and to find our own giftedness and to make use of that. So, there is that energy. There is a scene from a movie that I would like to talk about briefly. I wonder if some of you or all of you have seen the movie Throw Mama from the Train. It's a comedy that is quite an enjoyable movie. But it has very much to do with the aspect of creativity. It stars Billy Crystal and Danny DeVito. And Billy Crystal is a professor of English at a university in California who is teaching a night class to get people involved in being creative. Tell your story. Be writers. And Danny DeVito is one of his students. And Danny is trying desperately to write the classic story. And of course, at the same time, Billy Crystal has his eyes set on writing the ultimate classic, too, to be the top seller for months and months and months, whatever it would take to be on the New York's bestseller list. Well, unfortunately, in the movie, there are two women involved in the movie that are the heavies. And I think a part of the language over the weekend is for your own mind to set your own language structure, inclusive language, but also to cast yourself in a good spot and to make some men the heavies too, if that needs to be taken. But in this movie, the women are heavies, unfortunately. Danny DeVito lives with his mother, and the mother is something else. She has no regard for Danny DeVito in any other way than to be the servant for her needs. And she whips him into shape by abusing him verbally. And of course, Danny's very passive in the movie. On the other hand, Billy Crystal, his wife has stolen his prize novel, has run off to Hawaii, and has had it published under her name. It becomes a great hit, and it's a national seller. So Danny DeVito's angry because he's living with mom who doesn't care about his creativeness. Billy Crystal is very angry at his wife for running off and taking his creative energy and making a hit for herself. So they conspire. They're going to do in mama and they're going to do in his wife at the same time. And the movie goes on to that plot. I don't want to go any further with it. You haven't seen it. It's a great movie. Anyway, what I want to get to is there's one scene in the movie that is totally classic. I mean, I could run it again and again and again, and it's just a beautiful statement of affirmation for the giftedness of the parental and the child. Billy Crystal, or Danny DeVito, gets out a little cigar box, and he says to Billy in one scene, he says, "You want to see my coin collection?" And Billy says, "Hey, that sounds great. I'd love to see a coin collection." So he gets it out, and he pulls the money out of this box. It's a bunch of coins. And he dumps them out on the ground. They lay down on the floor. And it's just regular money. There's no value except for the price of, you know, a nickel is a nickel, and a penny is a penny, and a dime is a dime. Billy says, "Hey, come on. You know, this is just money." But then Danny picks one up and he says, "You know, this penny was a penny that I've saved from the time that my dad and I went to the baseball game when the Cubs played the Phillies. And this is a nickel here when we went down to the beach and he bought me a special big ice cream cone." You know, by this time he's going through all of his money, and of course Billy Crystal's just kind of melting because he realizes the value of what he's talking about. And the talent of Scripture and the talent as money has a lot to do with what was going on in that scene. He valued his father. His father valued him, which in essence is the spark that is needed for all of us to jump into hyperspace with our own creativity. Somebody needs to give us a word of affirmation, a handshake, a pat on the back. That's a great thing that you're doing to affirm us so that we can begin to recognize within ourselves our own esteem to begin the journey of finding our own creativity. Those of us, and I speak for myself, and this may strike some of you as well,
In the dysfunction of family, or the dysfunction of school, or the dysfunction of our jobs, or even maybe the dysfunction of something that's happened to us in church or in the wider society, someone has told us it's not okay to be ourselves. In my case, it started in the family. So the value of myself probably was something like that penny. I didn't think much of myself. And yet as I grew and began to recognize that I had a talent to do artwork, I began to see within myself that I had some kind of potential. So my value began to climb, so that I felt more like a nickel instead of a penny. As time went on, and people began to affirm me of the kinds of artwork that I was doing, sold a piece or two, began to feel that I was making a contribution to the overall largeness of life, I felt more like a dime. To be careful about these visual aids, because the money source gets a little bit bigger, to make sure I get this back in my pocket. Then as I began my spiritual journey and began to identify my own spirituality along with my own creativity, I began to realize that perhaps I was maybe worth a little bit more money. And I went to college, I put my spirituality to use, came out with an advanced degree in ministry, the value of me begins to increase a little bit more. Now I come to a point in my journey where I can begin to speak before groups. I can tell my personal story. I know that I am affirmed by those around me, and that my creativity becomes more and more powerful. So talents have funny things. Talents are the abilities within us, but talents are also a resource, so that just like the person in the bank who puts the money in there to gain interest, the money becomes even more valuable. The talents become even more valuable. The idea of individual creative spirituality, and the subheading is finding the artist in each person, is to not make you into artists, not to make you painters, not to make you dancers, not to make you weavers, although if that's what it's about, then that's fine. But on the back wall, I'll direct your attention to what it says on one of the statements. It is not the engineer, the scientist, the teacher, or the politician who will reshape the future. It will be the artist and each of us who will pull the chaos together and make a new, revisioned shape of society and the world. When I first heard that statement, I stopped and said, hey, wait a minute, I'm an artist. I mean, you're telling me, or I'm reading, that it's up to me to take care of the future? And we need to look at that in general terms. The artist in each one of me and in you is the creative wellspring to be whatever you're meant to be. And that may mean that you have an answer for some of the conditions that we are involved with in our lives today. The artistic quality for each of us means somebody might have an answer for the ozone problem. Somebody might have an answer for the garbage problem. Somebody might have an answer for curing AIDS. Somebody might have an answer for population problems. So the artist in us is the same thing that God did, because God loved us so much, was to send Jesus to us. Because Jesus, in essence, was the greatest artist. Jesus came down in the midst of chaos politically, economically, and everybody thought, well, the leader's coming and we're going to kick back, because Jesus is going to solve everything for us.
And yet when Jesus arrived, he came as the artist. He talked about stories and parables, making people sit forward and say, what did he say? Encouraging them to think more clearly, to get them out of their lethargy into an active life. And what was the response from the establishment? Or from the establishment from any country under present conditions? They did not like the artist in Jesus, because Jesus called them to think and be creative. And it's the same thing going on today. In the oppressed countries of the world, the artist is the first one to be slain, because the artist calls us to think, calls us to reflect, calls us to peace and justice, calls us to issues that we'd rather not face. So it's the artist, the creative person, who is the first one to be taken care of, so that the other people then will sit back and assume that because the artist is gone, then life will be put back into normal. Put my talent back in my pocket.
You never know what artists are present.
That's right. So in the short time tonight, just tickling your fancy to make you aware of the kinds of things that we will be doing later on in sessions. I have a board here, but I'm not going to write on it at the moment. Tomorrow morning there is a session that I would like to work with, assuming that you can all come. There is a predictable pattern, a progression from beginning to end. If you can't come to some, it's okay. Tomorrow I would like to be able to do the right left brain orientation, do a short talk off of that to determine who we are, why we do what we do, that it's not wrong where you are in your thinking and acting out abilities, and then do a play activity, to actually do an art assignment to get you to think from the left, work from the right, so that they both come together to a finished end, and to find surprises along the way. And in the area of activity of art, part of the reason that art is so popular with people is because it allows them to free up, to come up with answers that they thought not possible. And so I'm going to do give you a play activity that allows you to have an aha experience, to come to the reality of answers and see things that you didn't think would be possible or would be evident as you did a particular assignment. Then later, during the course of the next 2 days, I would like to talk about a headline that states fatal memories. How we get involved with dysfunctional habits that crush the creative spirit. And then reasonable miracles, and how to break dysfunction with stories and with scripture. And tomorrow afternoon, I'll be working with the Sojourner group, and everyone is welcome to come. We'll be talking about moods, what moods have to do with the creative unconscious, and how we can bring the unconscious energy of ourselves into our consciousness, and how that can be used in a creative way. So those particular ideas, issues, will be going through the next couple of days.